Well, hey there, this is Nona Jones. Thanks for tuning in to a new episode of Undefeated. You know, if you're new to Undefeated, I want you to know that the reason why I created this podcast and my Facebook Live talk show is because I think we often walk into the successful chapter that a person's life is on, and we assume that that's been their entire story. But I know from personal experience and the experience of very successful friends that many times the successful people we admire are simply products of wrestling with discouragement, failure, and trauma, and emerging on the other side of it undefeated. My guest today is certainly no exception. You know, I've been very fortunate within my career to have a pretty steady trajectory of wonderful opportunities. Of course, there have been disappointments along the way. That's just par for the course of any professional journey. But I've never had a failure that was super public or something that could have left me feeling ashamed and not even wanting to show my face in public anymore. But my guest today has exhibited strength and resilience that is frankly inspiring. His resume is long. It was in his role as president of CNN US that he led the network to its highest ratings ever. He was incredibly successful, and for 6 years, he was riding high until he was fired. Wow. Who saw that coming? The question for him is, how do you bounce back after career heartbreak? Some of you may have experienced that in the past, but John Klein has lived with it at a level that most people will not ever experience. And I believe what he's learned is insightful for us all. Listen, before we jump into the conversation, if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, please do and take a moment to rate it. I would also encourage you to invite your friends and your family to also subscribe, because these conversations are necessary.
John, if you were to look up the word success in any dictionary, I truly believe that your headshot could be the visual. I mean, multiple Emmys and Peabodys and just so many accolades. You've held all types of influential leadership roles. You're friends with very powerful people. But I would love it if you could take us back, you know, before the awards, before the acclaim. You know, who was John Klein before you were the John Klein we know?
You know, first of all, thank you for that. But I always was a person who just enjoyed doing things that were fun and interesting and that might engage other people or entertain them or amuse them. I was a morning radio disc jockey while I was in college. I wrote a humor column. I wrote musicals. I just liked to do things, and my definition of success always was, did that work? Did it get to somebody, whether it was just a laugh or a thought or, you know, a tear or something like that. And the awards and all of that stuff are nice to have, but you know, it's funny. I came to believe that I was never getting awards for my best work. I was getting awards for work that was was fine, but met some sort of conventional standard of quality. And that never was what I was after. So for me, the awards are a good badge. They're a good shorthand for people who don't know you to presume that you've got talents and abilities before you've proven that you have them. But for me, I you can't really take those to heart. So that's who I always was. And, I was very fortunate, very lucky in my life and in my career to receive opportunities to do the things that I really love. And I was also fortunate to have parents who made me feel that I could do anything that I set my mind to doing. And I know not everybody has a childhood that equips them to feel that way. And I was really lucky that I did. And that helped me an awful lot as I entered the world.
You know, I think when people see a successful person, you know, they admire the glitz, the glamour of it all. But something you just said strikes me. You basically said you got your start kind of at the bottom, like everybody else, in the news world. And I'm curious, you know, it's known as such a kind of cutthroat industry, the broadcast industry. What made you even decide to go into it and work your way up?
I think I was oblivious to the cutthroatness. I was just having such a good time, and you know, loved every day of it. But you know, I got a job right out of college at the, talk about starting at the bottom. I got the lowest level job at the worst station in Providence, Rhode Island. It was so bad that we weren't even located in Providence. We were in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which was 45 minutes away. And ancient studios and horrible equipment, but I loved every day of it. And one day, one of our reporters quit, and they asked me to fill in as the reporter for a couple of weeks. And that was an amazing adventure. And I did a bunch of stories, and I got to run around town in the Action News car and all that. And I was getting on the air every night. This is to your point about cutthroat. And when my 2-week stint was over, I had to go back to working on the assignment desk and doing 100 other things. I thought, you know, I ought to collect all the highlights of, you know, all the work that I had done on the air and save it on a reel. And who knows, maybe I'll decide to be an on-air reporter. And when I went to pull those tapes, someone had erased all of my pieces that I had done. I went to the air checks of each show, and the shows were there complete, except when we got up to my story, someone had erased them.
Wow.
And now I knew somebody had it out for me, but I also couldn't obsess over that. I just sort of went about my business, and you know, it's gone, you know, it's gone forever. But that's where I think maybe one's mindset comes into play. If I were prone to paranoia, or if I were, I guess, easily defeated or daunted, that might have done me in or slowed me down. Or maybe I was just oblivious. Maybe I was just too young and naive, and I had been raised to think that the world was a purely friendly place and all good things would happen. And so I just kept going. And you know, but yes, it can be that. But it's just such. If you're doing something that you love, whatever it is, you would tend to not dwell on the obstacles, mm-hmm. but rather see the obstacles as part of the fun of what you're doing. I mean, we're in the middle right now. You and I are helping to create a 24-hour live streaming event featuring the world's leading spiritual and inspirational figures. It's the single most complex thing I've ever done in my life.
Wow.
At this moment, everything is crashing in on me. But my wife was just saying to me, well, you're really having a great time, aren't you? I am. You know, I mean, of course, there's going to be headwinds, and there's going to be trouble, and there's going to be, you know, but overall, we're all lucky to be here, to have this experience. And if you're engaged in something that you love to do, and in this case, it's such a good cause, it's, you know, it's meant to give spiritual uplift to people around the world at this terribly dark time, then a couple of bumps in the road really aren't going to slow you down.
I think that's so powerful, John, the way that you framed the fact that, you know, yeah, this thing happened, but it didn't mean it was the end of, you know, the world for you. But what's interesting is some people have things like that happen, and they do think it's the end of the world. You know, they think, oh my gosh, you know, I'm never going to, you know, make it, or, you know, maybe this is a sign that I'm not cut out for this. Can you take us a little bit deeper into, like, how did you develop that mindset? Because that's actually pretty rare to have that kind of resilience mindset. Where did that come from?
It's got to be my parents. You know, childhood is such the critical formulator of one's inner itself. You know, there's a lot that you're born with, but then there's a lot that gets laid on top of you. And my parents, you know, I was the only son in a family. I had two sisters, so I think I was treated a little better than they were. I had a personality that just enjoyed having a good time, so maybe it was easier to sort of, you know, treat me nicely. And my sisters were a handful, so, you know. But it's that. I think your parenting is so important. And my parents just always convinced me that I could do anything I wanted to do. You know, my dad told me something very formative when I was in first grade. My dad's an artist. He's still alive, thank goodness. He's 90 years old. And he's an artist, and he was the principal of the school that they made the movie Fame about. It was a school for artistic and musically gifted performers. And he came home one day, and I was coloring on the floor of my room in first grade. And I was coloring the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria sailing to the New World. And I had not done the sky yet. He said, well, it's a really pretty picture, but why haven't you drawn in the sky? I said, oh, I'm out of blue. He said, oh, well, the sky doesn't always have to be blue. The sky can be any color you want. It's your painting. And that really hit me. That I remember him telling me that, and I remember storing that away. And that's really kind of been my guiding principle, that that sky can be whatever color you decide. I mean, look at the world that we live in today, where new inventions are coming around every minute. And they're all from people for whom the sky doesn't have to be blue. Yeah. And that's what I've carried around. And that comes from childhood.
I want to talk about your trajectory, because I really believe that those of us who have found purpose, those of us who have really found a calling, we've been ushered along the path toward it, and many times through rejection. I think sometimes people think that rejection is a bad thing. I think that rejection actually can be a good thing, in that it helps direct you toward your purpose. As you were speaking, I just remembered something that happened to me when I was in college. I was a communications major, thought I was going to become this journalist and all of this. And I remember I auditioned for the college news station. I wanted to be an anchor. And after the auditions, I looked at the list and who was selected, and I didn't see my name. And I just said, then I was like, well, I guess it's not meant to be. And I went away, and I completely changed my major, did something else. Well, I found out later that apparently my name was on the list, and apparently I was selected, but somehow I overlooked it. But if it had not been for that, I would not be where I am today. Do you have any examples of, as you were making your way down your own career trajectory, things that happened that actually took you closer to where you needed to be?
Boy, that's a great question. And by the way, you would have been an amazing anchor. I mean, that's too bad. You would have been bored of it by now anyway. It's very assembly line. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't get to follow your own path either. You know, what you're doing right now, you really can chart your course. I have had less, it's for me been less about rejection than about sudden dead ends. I was on a rocket ship ride at CBS News. I started as a writer on the overnight shift. Again, low level job at the worst shift in the whole place, at a brand new show that had no budget. And I was 23 years old and, whatever, an afterthought to the organization. But the people on that show went on to become chairman of CBS News and executive producer of 60 Minutes, the producer of CBS Sunday Morning, and some other really, accomplished people. There was a great group of people, but I got on this rocket ship ride. And I ended up 16 years later as executive vice president of CBS News. I was overseeing 60 Minutes and the primetime shows and all of that. And in between, I'd gotten to do a lot of really interesting stuff, all like building off of, you know, success over success over success. And that was great. And all of a sudden, I realized that I wasn't happy being executive vice president, fancy title, but the job itself was nowhere near as fun as making documentaries, which I had been doing before I got that job. And I also found out that the people I was overseeing weren't crazy about me. You know, some of these big stars, Mike Wallace, and, you know, who I had good friendly relationships with, but they didn't take well to being subject to a 37-year-old when they were 75 and upwarding. And I'm sure I didn't handle it well either. And so suddenly I was sort of at a dead end. You know, it was like, I'm not going to become president of CBS News anytime soon because my boss had just gotten the job. And so he wasn't going anywhere for a while. And what was I going to do? Just sort of sit around here? And that was my first real sort of punch in the nose moment. Like, oh, wow. All I'm done here. I had been on this ride and now I'm here. I wasn't getting fired or anything. I wasn't, you know, I could have stuck around, but I felt done. And out of that, I was lucky because this was 1998 and the internet was exploding for the first time as a consumer proposition. And I went and started an internet startup called The Feed Room, which was one of the first streaming video aggregators. We were YouTube about 6 years before YouTube was born, meaning 6 years too soon, because not enough people you know, the idea of streaming video on your computer at the time was kind of foreign. So we were, you know, we were in an uphill battle, but it was my first experience of having to figure something out. And it turned out to be incredibly fun, and it opened up the entire path that I have been on since for the last 22 years now, you know, which is mixing traditional media with technology. And that's everything I've done since, including CNN, was about that. I was hired as president of CNN US because I had that blend of journalism and technology. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted in 2004 when I went there. And so, you know, and then from there, then I launched my subscription video platform, Tap Media. And again, the one built on the next. And so encountering those sort of obstacles can really open up opportunities if you don't take the obstacles personally.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about your leadership at CNN, because from everything I've read, you were pretty intentional about really working hard to keep the network focused on, you know, hard news, solid reporting. You really didn't want to get into kind of the partisan, you know, the politattainment type stuff. What made you choose to swim against that current? Because it would have been so easy to just say, hey, let's just do whatever, you know, people want. But you said, no, this is what we want to be as a network. What made you choose to do that?
Well, first, it was my background in journalism, you know, from all those years at CBS News and before that in local TV news. But secondly, then it was my experience in business running my own company, The Feed Room, after that, which taught me the importance of differentiation, of swimming against the tide, of doing the things no one else is doing. And at that time, in 1998, all of these AOL pop-up lookalike type websites were coming along, and that's what everybody was trying to create. And I created a video website, which was the right idea at the wrong time. At CNN, clearly what we had to do was differentiate ourselves from Fox on the right and MSNBC on the left. And covering the news is what everyone in the organization wanted to do. They wanted to do it better than they were doing it. And no one in either cable or broadcast was really throwing themselves into covering the news in depth with analysis and intelligence. So So I just figured, listen, it's the thing we're going to be best at, the thing we're going to be better at than anyone else. So let's dive in and just embrace that opportunity. So that it was fairly obvious what we ought to do. The big task was to convince everyone in the organization that it was okay not to imitate the competition, that it was okay to trust your gut and do what your soul was telling you was the right way to go. And 9 times out of 10, if you do that, you and double down on it and over-deliver on that, you're going to be different and better than what all the lookalikes out there are up to.
So after 6 years as president, I mean, you accomplished so much in that tenure. The network decided to change directions and to change leadership. And I think there are so many people who have experienced, you know, being let go from a job, but few in such a high profile type of role. I'd love it if you could, you know, take us into that experience, kind of how it unfolded and what you were thinking as it was all happening.
It unfolded slowly because it's those things don't happen as they are often depicted on TV or in cartoons or something, where suddenly you walk in the door and it's like, you're fired. We had, in the 6 years I was there, my team and I had doubled our profits for the network. This whole focus on journalism first, good journalism turned out to be great business. So we doubled our profits. We hit the highest ratings that network had ever achieved and has achieved since. We were still the record holders in terms of ratings, won more awards than they had ever won. But I think my bosses and I got tired of each other, just of the day in and day out, you know, compromises and decisions and pulling things apart and figuring stuff out. At some point, you know, sometimes there's just, you know, stress fractures develop. And I had actually had on my desk, they had extended my contract back in January. And for 8 or 9 months, it's literally sat on my desk. I didn't want to sign the contract extension. And my boss was coming to town and we were going to go have lunch. And so I thought, you know what, this is awkward. I should just sign it and be done. And it was at that lunch that he said, you know what, we ought to just end this. Like, they got the message that I was putting out. And then I got the message that, you know, in return. So it was, of course, it's no fun to go through that in public. I mean, when you're in that kind of job, it's like kind of being the manager of the Yankees. You know, eventually that ride is going to come to an end. And when it does, everybody's going to read about it. I was lucky in the sense that my friend Jeff Zucker was taken out of his job as chairman of NBC Universal Television the same morning. So it totally bounced me off the media pages that day. And we joked about it privately. But, you know, it's traumatic to go through in that, you know, suddenly, you have to think again about what's going to come next. And you have to address, you know, people want to feel bad for you. And people want to, it's nice in a way because, you know, people do reach out and want to make you feel better. But it's also, I don't like a lot of attention. I don't like to talk about myself, even though I've been sitting here talking about myself for 25 minutes. There's a bit of that, but I've never been one to identify myself with the job. The job is not my identity. The job is the thing that I'm doing because of the person I am. But that person is what I take with me wherever I go. And you build up relationships in that way that have nothing to do with the job itself. And I have found just in doing the call to unite, which we're putting together right now, I called upon people I had worked with at CNN to come and help me put this massive event on the air Friday night. I called in people I've worked with at the feed room, you know, 20 years ago, friends from CBS, I was just emailing with today to help promote it and publicize it. So that's who you are. You are the person with these connections, and that goes with you wherever you go. And I've always been pretty quick to shed the label. In fact, while I'm in those jobs, I don't even wear the label that much. I don't put myself out there as that thing. That's a trap, I think, that people can fall into, is to conflate themselves with their title or their awards or what they might read about themselves somewhere. You have to be who you are. That's what's going to survive the bad times. It's what's going to survive as you get older, you know, when your kids are gone, and now it's you and your spouse or not, you know, and you're just out there in the world. That's who you are. When you close your eyes and just breathe and hear yourself breathing, that's who you are. You're not all those other things. And so is everyone else. And it's a good level.
This is so powerful, John. I think someone like you, especially someone like you, who very well could be tied to your accomplishments, your titles, your roles. I mean, you very well could be. There are some people who are tied to those things and they haven't achieved much, but you've achieved a lot. To hear you say that is just really inspiring, and I'm grateful for your example. My last question would just be, if you could speak to anyone who's watching this, who maybe they are in that state where, say, they've lost a job that they were receiving their sense of purpose and identity from, or maybe there was something else that happened in their life. We have people getting cars repossessed right now, people who are losing their home, and things that in many instances are our identity. What would you say to them to help them build just a sense of renewed purpose?
I would say, don't be afraid to reach out and ask for the help, because everybody who you might ask needs some kind of help also. We're much more connected than we think we are. And especially at a time like this, so many more people are in need, people who never thought they would be in need. And it may be that those people are even more frightened than you are, because they never expected this at all. And if you are one of those people who just didn't see that, just knowing that you're in the same boat as a lot of people, you know, can help a lot. I think people are just basically very good. And if you ask for the help, it could be, listen, I can't pay that rent this month. Well, can you help me out? I can't make it. I can't feed my kids, so I have to, you know, do something about that. Can I, you know, asking for that kind of help, I think, is going to be returned, because I think that's certainly the mode that people are in right now. But I also think it's kind of a basic human orientation. And sometimes it's tough to ask for that, but now's the time.
This has been so powerful, John. As we close, I would love it if you could just share a little bit about the Call to Unite happening tomorrow, which I'm so grateful for you making time during this crazy day to sit down and talk with us. We've got a lot of people watching this who I think this will resonate with. So I would love it if you would just share what they can expect, when they can join, because it's such a great initiative.
Thanks so much, Ryan. And thank you for your help in helping get the word out, not only here, but across Facebook, which has been a powerful friend for us in this. We've got a collection of some of the world's most powerful spiritual and inspirational figures. It kicks off with Oprah Winfrey talking with Bishop T.D. Jakes for 25 minutes. And it's just extraordinary. And I work with Bishop Jakes on his streaming channel called Bishop's Village, and I've gotten to know him. I go down for my birthday to just sit there and let him wash over me, and I'm Jewish, and I drag my wife down there, and I love it. There are people like him, Eckhart Tolle, you know, more of a philosopher. Rick Warren is taking part, Judith Smith, Chad Veach, Ty Tribbett, and leaders from around the world who I've never heard of, but who brings so much wisdom and insight and tools that we can use, not only to get through this moment, but to come out of it in a better place, kind of a personal reset and a societal reset. So that is kicking off tomorrow, Friday night, May 1st, 8 p.m. Eastern on Facebook and other platforms. And, you know, it's on for 24 hours. So, I envision people are just going to put their phone up against the wall, go do what they're going to do, or flip the laptop open and go about their business. And every so often, you're going to hear something that catches your ear, and you're going to pull more closely into it and really get a lot out of it.
There are so many things that John said that will stick with me. I mean, he's just so wise and humble. I think the thing that I'm going to take away from this and truly try to apply to every area of my life is what he said about identity. Our identity should not be wrapped up in our job. It shouldn't be wrapped up in a title. It shouldn't be wrapped up in anything other than who we've been created to be. I think it's tempting to wrap ourselves around being vice president of something. It's easy to wrap ourselves around being a spouse or even our family name. It's easy to wrap ourselves around that. But when we do that, if those things get taken away, what do we have left? I don't know about you, but I feel like this conversation has helped me to recalibrate myself on who I am, what I'm doing, and why. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as I have. I want you to come back same time next week for another inspiring conversation. Thanks for joining me. See you then.